It's out there. It's so crystal clear to me.
It's not that the society is socially conservative and they're rejecting you. They're rejecting you because you're an outsider.
Yeah, you know, more courage and integrity are at the heart of what I always thought we did in the military.
Has it made you revisit what your experience in the 34 years serving the British Army was like?
I say to people, be on the right side of history. And all those people that are, you know, cheerleading the IDF now, you know, when it is declared a genocide, how are you going to feel about yourself? How are you going to look yourself in the eye? They've made it completely unlivable. They have created the conditions whereby it is almost impossible for two million Palestinians to exist.
And whoever else is coming into Afghanistan to kind of fix that are going to be seen as this invading colonial other entity and are going to be resisted by almost all parts of society, if not physically, then at least emotionally or psychologically.
We created the insurgency, which eventually defeated us.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Charlie Herbert, can you hear me okay? Testing 1, 2, 3. Good.
Sounded very military.
That's me. Can't change that, I'm afraid.
Okay, I'm just going to clap and then we'll start. 3, 2, 1. Hi, good day and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Major General Charlie Herbert.
Thank you. No, it's a real privilege to be here, sir. Thank you for asking me here today.
Thank you. Those of you who are not familiar with Charlie Herbert's Twitter or his previous interviews, he's been an extremely outspoken, morally clear voice against Israel's atrocities in Gaza for a long while, but especially over the last 2 years of Israel's genocide. So you're here today because I think your perspective is interesting. As a former major general in the British Army, we were just discussing as you were walking in, sort of why is it that so many members of the military establishment, past or present, seem to not have the clarity you do. You obviously didn't want to take the side of saying I have more clarity than them, but from my perspective, why is it that you think differently to them?
That's a really interesting question. And I can't speak on behalf of them, of course. I can only give you, I mean, in terms of those people who are still serving, they're not able to comment, and you see that they don't comment, and even very senior officers find themselves unable to comment. The MOD press office just won't allow them to do so, and it's too politically sensitive. Why don't more people, more veterans, speak out? That's a really kind of interesting question. And I spend a lot of time over the last couple of years sort of considering that. And I chuck stuff out on LinkedIn to my ex-military network just to kind of see what the take-up is. And it's remarkable how many people don't want to engage in what I think is a relatively black and white issue here. Why is that? I don't know. A lot of ex-military people go and work for the defense industry. And I think they feel incapable or unwilling to speak out, particularly if they're going to speak out in any negative way about the Israeli Defense Force. That's not going to be good for their career or their business prospects. Others, I'm slightly baffled by. You know, we spend a lot of time in the military talking about the law, international law. We talk about ethics. We talk about values and standards. We live by a particular code of values and standards, loyalty, self-discipline, you know, all of these things. And, you know, moral courage and integrity are at the heart of what I always thought we did in the military, particularly in the army. And I am slightly dismayed at the number of people who seem incapable of looking at what has gone on in Gaza over the last 2 years and seem incapable of coming up with an objective view on it. You know, many people, they just seem willing to excuse the Israeli Defense Forces of everything that they may do, irrespective of the illegality of it. And I find that staggering. I mean, I didn't set out to be a critic of Israel or the Israeli Defense Forces. I set out 2+ years ago to be a commentator. And my initial posts and my initial engagements with the media were really more about cautioning Israel about avoiding the same mistakes that the United States and her allies, including the UK, made after 9/11. And it was pretty clear that after the 7th of October that Israel were going to lash out, violently in retribution and in anger, and one can understand that to a certain extent. But the danger with doing that is one very quickly loses one's moral compass. And we saw exactly that with the United States after 9/11. We saw the incidents of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. You know, we saw instances with UK forces in southern Iraq after 2003. It's very easy when one is anger and when one is blind and when one goes into this kind of military approach without thinking strategically, without thinking about the political outcomes, you know, that actually you just become the monster that you seek to destroy. And that is exactly what Israel did. and they fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So I didn't seek to criticize them at the beginning. I just seek to comment objectively, you know, on what I thought Israel should do sensibly and logically and strategically in response to the events of the 7th of October. I wasn't a commentator on Israel and Palestine before the 7th of October. You know, I'd visited Israel. I've never been to Gaza. I am by no means an expert. Absolutely not an expert. I have some experience in the military, spent 34 years in the army, but limited experience in Israel and Palestine. Spent a lot of time in the Middle East, of course. But yeah, I found myself, certainly by January 2024, what, sort of 2 to 3 months in, I found myself absolutely mortified, horrified by the Israeli response, by what I viewed as a military campaign that was lacking in distinction between combatants and civilians, was lacking in proportionality, you know, aspects of it were grossly illegal. So yeah, so I found myself moving from an objective commentator to a fairly fierce critic of what I saw, and that hasn't changed. I've become more critical.
So you mentioned becoming more critical, and I think it's been so long. Do you believe it's a genocide? Because I'm going to about to say it's the genocide's been unfolding. Do you think it's a genocide? Yeah.
It's hard to say it's not a genocide, isn't it? It's really difficult to look you in the eye.
Yes.
And say, I don't think this looks like a genocide. I can't rule legally, and it's going to take what, until the end of 2027, 2028, until we get the ICJ ruling. Watch this. I say to people, be on the right side of history. And all those people that are, you know, cheerleading the IDF now, you know, when it is declared a genocide, how are you going to feel about yourself? How are you going to look yourself in the eye, you know, in the future?
Okay. Because it's been 2 years of an unfolding genocide, we often, like the human mind kind of, it's wired to remember the most recent thing. And so it may be difficult for us to grapple with how long we've been seeing atrocities, because initially the atrocities were, we were seeing buildings and buildings were going up in smoke, and we saw kids being pulled to the hospital and, you know, often really gruesome sights. Unfortunately, I mean, blood everywhere. And then we kind of saw rubble and people starving and people running and getting shot. And, you know, through that process, there was a lack of aid being given. We saw people being, you know, really, some of them emaciated. There's been a lot of controversy in the media that a lot of those people were completely emaciated, had pre-existing conditions. We did see a lot of, you know, thin and impoverished people in Gaza. So I think that's not up for debate at all. And now you see a militarization of the entire Gaza Strip being divided into two. We've seen Israel trying to unleash sort of civil disturbance within Gaza by sort of arming gangs. So there's been all sorts of games, and we just see the most recent atrocity we see. So for example, when you came in again, we were speaking about the fact that there were two young people in Jenin, Palestinians, who were just shot last night. In your own words, just. And you also mentioned that as this has gone on, you've become even more critical of Israel's behavior, which I think is just the norm for everyone who's become critical of Israel. But just walk us through, in your mind, which were some of the moments which stand out for you, both calculated and random, as just, what is this? Like, how do we have this level of barbarity in the 21st century?
I mean, it's extraordinary. I think there's a danger, but we just view this as a conflict of the last 2 years. And we fail to put this into its historical context of the last 80 odd years. I think this is a really important thing. This is just one act in a continuum of violence that has been going on since the late 1940s, through the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, you know, war against Gaza. And there's a real danger that we only look at it through the prism of Gaza. And that's a massive mistake. And I think this is Trump's fundamental mistake. He's failing to understand the much wider Arab-Israeli issue here, much wider Palestinian issue, statehood, occupation, etc. That's my kind of first point. I controversially, I would argue that Israel had an inherent right to self-defense on the 7th of October. You know, many people would legally argue that they didn't necessarily because of the nature of the occupation. And there are some compelling grounds there. But I would say as a state, Israel had a right to self-defense on the 7th of October. I would have urged, if I had been an advisor to Netanyahu and his Israeli, I would have urged them to take a long-term political approach to this conflict, and to place the use of a military instrument as part of just one instrument. This needs a long-term diplomatic approach. But it required a military approach. There was no doubt about that. But at the end of October, or from the 7th of October, Israel was going to use military force to try to bring about some level of destruction on Hamas. That was inevitable. And had they adopted a proportionate counter-terrorist approach to target the leadership of Hamas, to target those that took part on the 7th of October or involved in the planning, I think that could have understood that. What was fundamentally wrong is this business of proportionality and distinction. You know, and by the end of what? By November? I mean, we saw this just staggeringly disproportionate air campaign. Whole areas, whole residential accommodation blocks being destroyed by the Israeli Air Force. So from the very, very outset, you know, it was looking wrong. It was looking abhorrent. It was looking like a grossly disproportionate response. I mean, the time for me when I thought, yeah, this is just off the pale was probably about late December, early January 2024, when photographs were coming out of Gaza by some very, very brave journalists, you know, Palestinian journalists working inside Gaza. Photographs were coming out of large groups of Palestinian men of fighting age, by which I mean anywhere from the age of 18 to 60, who had been detained by the Israeli Defense Forces and were being held on their knees, often stripped down to their underpants. They had their hands behind their heads. And I just thought, this just kind of looks wrong. We didn't do mass detentions like this in Iraq and Afghanistan against civilians. And then, you know, these men were mistreated. The stories that were coming out of a level of mistreatment, extrajudicial killings which were going on. Some of the footage which was coming out in early 2024, it was just kind of staggering. It just looked like a bloodfest that the IDF were on. Anybody, I think, at that stage would start to realize that this was just fundamentally wrong. Wherever one sat on the political spectrum, this was just fundamentally wrong. And if you just take that aside, it's illogical. It is strategically illogical, strategically illiterate, what the Israelis are doing here. This is in no way, that conflict, the last 2 years, is in no way going to bring about a better peace. It's guaranteeing another generation of conflict between Palestine and Israel. It's absolutely guaranteeing it. And that doesn't make any sense. There was a moment, I thought, after the 7th of October, there was a once-in-a-generation moment for Israel to try to take stock of what had happened and for Israel to collectively as a nation try to understand the roots of Palestinian discontent and resistance. And to look themselves in the mirror and to use this as an opportunity to try to address the root causes of a conflict that has been going on for the last 70 years, to address the issues of occupation, to address the issues of Palestinian statehood. But they chose not to do that. They absolutely chose to ignore that, you know, in favour of a violent, genocidal, disproportionate military campaign that serves absolutely no long-term purpose or good, as far as I can see. And then, you know, at every sort of stage along the way, we've seen further evidence of Israeli crimes. I mean, I think the ICJ genocide case, you know, if that didn't make people sit up and take notice, nothing would. I think the ICC arrest warrants against Netanyahu and Gallant and others, again, would make anybody sit up and take notice. You can't ignore those international bodies. You cannot just choose to ignore, you know, those multilateral bodies that were set up in the 1940s post-war to prevent this kind of conflict from happen again. You cannot avoid the really prominent Jewish voices that are out there that are labelling this as a genocide. You see these extraordinary people on the marches in London, Holocaust survivors and children of Holocaust survivors, who have a moral courage and a clarity to come out and march against what they see as this awful war. It's out there. It's so crystal clear to me that this war was unlawful. It's been prosecuted in a genocidal manner, and it's strategically illiterate, and it will bring no good. It just creates another generation of conflict.
So you mentioned that it's, you know, it's strategically illiterate. You've mentioned it will bring a generation of conflict. I completely agree with that. But I think there are those on the, I would have said 2 years ago on the extreme right of Israel, but now I think it's a large portion of Israel who would argue that it, for them, from their perspective, this is strategically illiterate because they are kind of creating a, you know, they are going to try to ethnically cleanse and make it extremely difficult for Palestinians to even ever think of resistance. Now, I do think that you know, people who are occupied will always think of resistance. But I think Israel reached the point, not in a calculated way, just organically. If you look at, you know, the development since the 1940s, where there was an attempt at ethnic cleansing, and then, you know, a skirting of providing the Palestinians with a state for a long time, and then an occupation in 1967 of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, or initially an annexation from Jordan and Egypt, and then an occupation. And so there'll be those in Israel, and Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, and now even Netanyahu best represent that, where it's like, we are just going to actually mute the entire issue by ethnically cleansing or genociding to ethnic cleanse, killing as many people so that people feel that we rather leave. And so from their perspective, this is it. You see, I think we most of the people in the world have been socialized post-1940s to be like, we need to kind of get along. There's a lot of historical injustices, but we kind of have to abide by international law. And that, even if it's structurally unfair, will be, you know, we'll kind of minimize fallout. And I think that's been the approach of international relations. But Israel have decided, and I think the key thing is they've obviously been given a license to behave. Some would say surprisingly, some would say unsurprisingly, in this way where we are actually going to try to push out. Last night, settlers by themselves went into Syria and started building a settlement in Syria. And so I think that the Israeli society and its military leadership and its civil leadership have decided that this is strategically what they want to do. They want to make it extremely difficult to have Palestinian existence. And what's your response to that?
I don't disagree with a word you said, but I mean, you're absolutely right. My argument that I put forward earlier, you know, sort of presupposes that Israel want peace with their Palestinian neighbors. And that's a big assumption, isn't it? I think there are many people in Israel that would like that. There are many, many decent Israelis, but would like that. But you're absolutely right. You know, Smotrich, Ben-Gavir, Netanyahu, the far right over there, absolutely not interested. I think you're right. They saw the events of the 7th of October as an opportunity to justify exactly what you have just described there, the expulsion of the Palestinians, Nakba 2, Nakba 3, whatever you want to call it. No, absolutely right. And there's no doubt what we've done to Gaza, they've made it completely unlivable. They have created the conditions whereby it is almost impossible for 2 million Palestinians to exist. And yeah, what's really sad is this so-called 20-point peace plan is not going to make that any better for them. It's going to make it worse. So you're right. We've sort of, you know, people have fallen into the trap of probably what the Israeli political far right sought, you know, come the 7th of October. And there are some people that will tell you that the Israelis, you know, it was convenient for them to have what happened on the 7th of October because it provided that pretext to enable them to do this. I don't buy into that. I think it was a massive intelligence failure, a massive security failure, a bit like 9/11, intelligence and a security failure. But they have used it as a pretext to conduct, you know, what they have done over the last 2 years and will continue to do so. And what really worries me is that this, I can't even call it a peace plan. It's not a peace plan. You know, it's a frozen conflict. That's all that's happened. It's a frozen conflict that appears to allow the Israeli Defense Forces to continue their forever war against the people of Gaza. And that is absolutely what Netanyahu wants. Netanyahu doesn't want an end to this conflict. I totally agree with you. He's never wanted an end to this conflict. I think many in Israeli society don't want an end to this conflict. You know, it's a country that was formed in the crucible of fire and war from 1948 onwards. It's harsh to say. It's a country that almost needs perpetual conflict and war. And I feel harsh saying that, but I have concluded this over the last few years, but that's kind of where it is. You know, if it ever found peace with its neighbours, I mean, a lot of the funding that it gets from the United States, a lot of the support that it gets from around the world would probably dry up, and that would not be healthy for the political state of Israel. So, yeah, it's kind of difficult. I like to think good of most people, and I kind of like to think that majority of Israelis would like to live in some form of peaceful coexistence with the Palestinians and would like to find a solution that allows that. Whether that is a one-state solution, I don't think that's feasible, or whether that is some kind of two-state solution, but it's really difficult to work out what that would look like today.
Okay. I mean, polls in Israeli society taken by Haaretz in the last sort of 6 or 7 months have, because I too believed and I still like to hope that there are many people in Israel who would want a peaceful solution. I think the poll was that 47% believe that the Israeli army had a right to kill everyone who it occupies. And about 82% believe that Palestinians should be ethnically cleansed. So I mean, and this is the Israeli Jewish society, not the entire Israeli society, which, you know, 20% is sort of Palestinian, but Israelis call Israeli Arabs. So I mean, maybe that's just a wartime poll. Maybe when things kind of calm down, or now that it's 7 months old, maybe that would change. But that's just a poll from an extremely credible news organization, Haaretz. You mentioned that round about January, when, and that's probably, that's when the ICJ, when the actual hearing was taking place. That's when you were like, this is actually just beyond the pale and you don't understand what's going on. Did you expect, and I guess the answer is yes, but let's maybe I sort of go through it a bit more. But did you expect a stronger intervention from the international community at some point? When did you think it was like, did you like, were you sitting there thinking, I just can't understand why Biden is still sending weapons? And when you were thinking that, what was the calculus in your head? And when was this moment?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I predicted in October 2023, incorrectly predicted, that this would be a relatively short war. Yeah, Israel has only ever fought short wars. It has a doctrine of short wars, but end quite quickly, you know, after a matter of weeks or months. And I cited in numerous interviews for sort of a war against Lebanon in 2006, which the United States supported and condoned for about 31 days before they pulled the plug on it. And I thought that the United States would allow Israel to enact its revenge upon Hamas for about 2 to 3, maybe 4 or 5 months. And then I thought the US support would dry up. I thought US domestic support for it would completely dry up. And I thought European support for this conflict would kind of dry up. And I thought everybody by early 2024 would see that this was just inherently wrong and needed to stop. And I can't understand. I just cannot understand how first this conservative government of ours and then this Labour government of ours has continued to not just support politically what's going on in Israel, but has actually been complicit in it. You know, whether that is flights from Cyprus, Royal Air Force aircraft, you know, flying over Gaza, hoovering up intelligence, apparently to support hostage rescue. I don't really buy into that. Whether that is us providing, you know, military support, whether that's us providing arms, material, funding, political support in the United Nations to Israel. I don't understand it. I just don't. My trust, I think as a nation, I think the UK and young people in particular, their trust in government in general is completely shattered by this. They've seen two successive UK governments that have blindly supported Israel in the face of all of the evidence that said that they shouldn't, against the public that have come out week after week and marched against UK support for this conflict. But government's just ignored us. It's completely ignored us. And it beggars belief. I mean, people say similar thing happened with the Iraq war in 2003. You know, a million people marched against the war and the government still went ahead with it. But that was over a relatively kind of short period of time. This has been over 2 years. It's kind of heartbreaking. You start to question, what more can one do? You know, what more can one do? And I think this is sort of weird kind of time and place now where we have pensioners who are prepared to go to Parliament Square and get themselves arrested because they are so disgusted by the actions of this government. I mean, that is extraordinary. That is really telling. People with unblemished records their whole life, people of upstanding reputations, teachers, you know, former police officers, former military officers even, who've gone out there and are willing to get arrested, you know, because they are so, so unhappy, so distraught in many respects about this government's support for what they view as a deeply illegal war. It's hard to explain. I wish I could succinctly explain what's kind of happening. But, you know, the idea that this is democracy is a farce. It's not a democracy. We're living in an authoritarian state. It's closing down political opposition to this war. You know, the banning of a prescription of Palestine action. It's a deliberate banning, intentional banning of political opposition. That's all it was. People should see that. This isn't about Israel. This isn't about Gaza. This is about the banning of a political opposition. And again, I think this has broken the public's trust and confidence in government. I really do. We're in a really bad place at the moment as a country, I think.
Okay, you mentioned, you know, the prescription of Palestine Action in your view is just the banning of political opposition. I mean, it's interesting because ruling parties would have so many things they would like to ban so that they could, you know, be more comfortable or stay in power. And obviously, there's been a lot of noise around, you know, the UK complicity or what protesters believe it's UK complicity in Israel's atrocities, even if it wasn't that, just the sort of outrage at Israel's atrocity in itself. Why is it that you know, from all the fights that the government could have chosen to fight or do or behave in a very deceptive way or in a very, you know, suspicious way, why this?
$1 million question, isn't it? I mean, you know, wouldn't one love to be a fly on the wall, you know, in some of these cabinet meetings or some of the meetings that take place in Number 10 and in other parts of Westminster? I don't know, the power of the pro-Israel lobby across the Atlantic in the United States, I always realized was strong. I don't think I'd realized quite how strong it was, but it is strong, and one only has to look at what's publicly available in the levels of, you know, funding from AIPAC give to, you know, US politicians to buy their votes and their support. What I hadn't realized is quite how powerful that lobby was here in the United Kingdom, and the last 2 years, I think, has exposed that to me. It's the only possible explanation for what seemed to be a, you know, illogical political decisions and outcomes. You know, the prescription of Palestine Action. I mean, why has so much political capital been wasted on that? Because of huge pressure being applied to this government to do so. It's just, it doesn't make any kind of sense. And where does it go next? It's really interesting. Yeah, I think like everybody, I'm shattered, I think, by the power of this unseen lobby that seems to so malignly shape and influence UK policy at the moment, UK politics and policy. It's extraordinary. And it's sort of really pernicious impact on the media. Daily Telegraph went after me about 18 months ago and ran a kind of smear piece on me. They dragged up a story from about 7 years ago, completely non-story.
Yeah, one is this the one where you were having champagne with some people?
Yeah, drinking champagne in Kabul. And, you know, I was sent home early, big deal. Non-story, 6-7 years ago. Is that really a story in the public interest? Yeah, as, you know, you only had to look at the comments on the Daily Telegraph website that day. As everybody said, this is just a really dirty, nasty smear campaign. This is a punishment beating for Charlie Herbert.
Yeah, no, I came across it when doing some research on you, and I was like, what is this?
But our media, they've played a really, really dangerous part in this, and a hugely... It almost inexplicable. Inexplicable, I think, to a certain extent. They seem incapable of calling out. So I was surprised, actually. So you mentioned the shooting dead of the two, you know, what was quite clearly a murder of two Palestinians in Jenin a day or two ago. And it's been splashed all over media. And lots of people predicted on social media that the BBC wouldn't run that story. It would just disappear it. But I was surprised to see the story was on BBC social media this morning. I'm surprised, because normally they would bury any kind of story like that. Yeah, they've played a really bad part in this campaign.
Okay. So, I mean, look, it's very clear that, I mean, that to anyone who's been listening to you or seeing you, that your stance on this comes from a place of moral clarity, comes from a place of being, you know, enraged, upset about atrocities. You did serve in the British Army for what, 34 years, I think. Right. When you see what has happened in the last 2 years, and I mean, I'm sure you had your own reflections even while serving, has it made you revisit what your experience in the 34 years serving the British Army was like? Like, what's it? Do you think that and say, was I sometimes, because you see, I come from what was once called the third world, now called the developing world. I come from South Africa. And in my mind, and in most South Africans' minds who aren't white, and it's not just South Africans, it's when I travel to India or Egypt or any place that was previously colonized, the idea was like the US Army first, and then the British Army are just these evil entities, right? And that comes from a legacy of 300-400 years. So when you see the last 2 years and what's occurred, does it make you rethink? And I've heard you say, and I don't think it's without credence, that, you know, you got involved in the army because of the idea of service, but also for humanitarian reasons. And I can see from your perspective, you know, why that was the intention. But when you see the last 2 years and you reflect over your service in the last 34 years, which we'll get to in more in-depth later on, does it make you rethink what it was all about?
Not really. I mean, if I'm being honest, not really. I'm very happy to talk about the Iraq War. I think mistakes were made, and yeah, I was a MOD planner in 2003 involved in planning, you know, for the invasion of Iraq, and I'm happy to kind of take questions about it. I think there were some gross strategic errors made there and mistakes. Overall, though, I still believe in the ability of the armed forces. I still believe that they are a deeply honourable institution. And I still believe that they do considerably more good than bad. I absolutely believe that. I think there are failures in how they're employed sometimes, but they tend to be political failures rather than failures of the military itself. And I'm not saying that, you know, there aren't some bad apples in every single organization, whether that's the United States Army or whether that's British Army. And it's really important that where transgressions or illegal actions take place, that they are dealt with appropriately and that people are punished and, if convicted, sentenced appropriately. And we have seen that, you know, during my time in the army. Yeah, my career is characterized by support to the police in Northern Ireland. I'm very proud of what I did. Very proud of what we did to eventually bring about a long-term political accommodation solution to Northern Ireland. In the 1990s, I was very much involved in the wars in the Balkans. I'm very proud of what I did there. We were there to enable the delivery of humanitarian aid to the civilians who were caught up in an atrocious war. And it's very sad, but a number of British soldiers lost their lives in providing that humanitarian aid. I was very involved in the campaign in Afghanistan. After 2001, I did 3 tours in Afghanistan and various tours in the Ministry of Defence supporting that campaign. I still believe that it was the right thing to do. I absolutely do. It was a flawed experiment in nation building. But I think everybody who served there had the right intentions. I genuinely believed that we were trying to do good. I genuinely believed it was the right thing to try to bring about a better form of democracy. I thought it was the right thing to try and support and enable equal rights, you know, education for girls, jobs for women. I still believe that was the right thing to do. Maybe what we did was overly ambitious and maybe mistakes were along the way. I still think we were right to fight a war against the Taliban initially. I thought they were an abhorrent organization when we overthrew them in 2001, an absolutely abhorrent organization. And the Afghans were delighted to see them go. What went wrong was over the period of 20 years, we should have realized earlier that we were caught up in a civil war and that we were ultimately supporting a side that was deeply corrupt, you know, Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani. So I think, you know, by the time it came to leave in 2021, it was right that we left. I struggled with that decision at the time, but I look back on it now. But no, I'm very proud of what we did in Afghanistan, and I'm very sad that 457 soldiers, you know, lost their lives over there, doing what they thought was the right thing and trying to make it a better place. Iraq's an interesting one, So I say, in late 2002, I was working in the Ministry of Defence. I was a young major in my early 30s. And like many people, I saw what became known as the dodgy dossier, you know, the weapons of mass destruction intelligence. And what I saw looked credible enough to me. I didn't question it. Maybe I was naive. And I think many of us were kind of caught up in that. And through 2002 and early into 2003, I genuinely thought that Tony Blair, the then president, was riding on the coattails of the United States, George Bush, so that he could exercise some kind of positive influence over the decision to go to war, whether or not we went to war, and the way in which that war has been prosecuted. And that was naive of me. I think Bush and Blair were always going to go to war in March 2003. I didn't realise that. And I don't think the UK were capable of any way influencing the US conduct of that war. And, you know, we unleashed a Pandora's box of problems which continue to this day. So the war in Iraq was wrong. And I think, you know, no sane person would deny that now. It was the wrong thing to do. It was based on false intelligence. Part of it, I think, stemmed back to 9/11, you know, and our determination to get retribution. I mean, we seemed incapable of delinking Saddam Hussein from Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden, and that was wrong. But no, to come back to your original question, I'm very proud of my military service. I wear my medals with honour. I accept that that is not a view that is shared by everybody politically, especially on the political left. they don't necessarily see the thing. Yeah, one of my proudest moments, if you ask me what was the time in my army career that I found the most satisfying, it was leading a multinational force in Sierra Leone in 2015 during the Ebola crisis, where we were working with the international community, with the World Health Organization, CDC, the Sierra Leone government, to bring about an end to Ebola and to save lives, to save tens of thousands of lives. I didn't carry a gun. That was a humanitarian mission. And a lot of what we do in the military is about a humanitarian mission. So, you know, you can hear me. I'm really passionate about the armed forces. I'm not always passionate about our political masters' decisions to commit us to campaigns. And this is where we've got to separate things. And I'm often asked, you know, isn't it disgusting, Charlie, that the Royal Air Force have been flying missions over Gaza, you know, since October the 7th? I'm like, yeah, it is. But don't beat up the pilots that are doing that. But don't beat them up. Beat up the government. That's a political decision to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that some of those pilots shouldn't have a moral courage to say, I think this is wrong. I don't think we should be doing this. And many people should resign. And I'm dismayed. I'm dismayed at how few people have resigned from the Foreign Office, from the MOD, from other government departments, those working for United. I find it extraordinary that there haven't been more resignations in protest at these extraordinary, you know, largely illegal government decisions over the last couple of years. I'm often asked about that and I can't explain it.
Okay, so there's two things I want to just touch on. So the one is, you know, you mentioned it's difficult. I mean, you're not sure why people are resigning. You've been an army officer, so I'm sure it's difficult for people to resign. Not, I mean, they obviously, there's a financial reason primarily, probably. You know, they have an idea of service. There's an idea, probably they're hoping that things will change. You know, they're doing this horrible thing right now, but next year they'll be on a humanitarian mission or at some point in the future. So just, I mean, speak a bit to that. And then, okay, and then I'll hold the other question for later so that you don't get confused with both questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy for me to stay here. And I said recently in the media, I would have resigned over this. It's easy for me to say that. I'm no longer, you know, in the military. I've got a large pension. You know, so it's very easy for me to say that. You know, when you've got a mortgage and you've got, you know, young children, it's a very kind of different thing to do. But I still think people could be more outspoken. I really do. I know privately there's a lot of dismay with the UK political mission in New York to the United Nations. They disagreed with a lot of government policy. I've got friends over there and I heard a lot of comments, a lot of muttering about this. They didn't agree with the decisions that were being taken. They didn't necessarily agree in which way in which the UN was voting in the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly. And it did kind of surprise me that more people, even just whistleblowers, I'm surprised we haven't seen more of this. There have been a few, you know, but I'm surprised there hasn't been more, to be quite honest. You know, this comes down to having moral courage to do what's right, to be quite honest. And I don't necessarily think there's been enough of that.
Okay. The other one's on Afghanistan. Now, I completely agree that the Taliban are an organization, an institution that should not be in charge of Afghanistan. It should not have been in charge of Afghanistan back in 2001, or I think it was like 92 or 91 when they actually came to power. And, you know, they have really, you know, created a lot of upheaval and destroyed large parts of on the whole, large parts of Afghan society. The US-UK invasion of 20 years also did that, right? So what do you think was, because you say there was lots of strategic errors with what happened in Afghanistan, and mentioned the same with Iraq. But before we get to Iraq, with Afghanistan, did you not see that while the Taliban are this horrible institution, US and UK or whoever else is coming into Afghanistan to kind of fix that are going to be seen as this invading colonial other entity, and are going to be resisted by almost all parts of society, if not physically, then at least emotionally or psychologically, and that will inevitably not be productive?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a degree of hubris and flawed assumptions in our planning. I mean, when we went into Afghanistan in late 2001, nobody at that time said, hey, this is going to be a 20 to 30 year campaign. You know, at its height, we're going to have 150,000 coalition soldiers in Afghanistan. Nobody anticipated that. This was really about dismantling al-Qaeda, capturing or killing bin Laden. In order to do that, one had to achieve regime change of the Taliban. And then I think the planning assumptions at the time is that, you know, we would then hand over to an Afghan force and everything would do. Where it all kind of went wrong was the Bonn Agreement, I think, took place about 18 months, didn't it? After 18 months, 2 years. And the Taliban were not invited to those talks. And we all know that if you don't talk to your enemies, the outcome is not going to be the one which we saw. So the Taliban were excluded, and then the Taliban, largely at that point, probably down in the southern Afghanistan and across the border in Pakistan, were able to kind of reconstitute. And we never really addressed genuine Pashtun grievances of the south and genuine grievances of the Taliban. And we helped to create a government under Hamid Karzai that didn't address the root causes of a problem but allowed the Taliban to come to power back in 1996. So there were big mistakes here. For the first couple of years, it was relatively peaceful, you know, and we had very small numbers of international soldiers in Afghanistan. I went out there in late 2002, early 2003. We probably had no more than about 300 or 400 British soldiers there at the time. We were all based in Kabul. And the country was relatively peaceful. And it was all looking relatively positive at that time. I think the mistake was that we believed that we could extend the writ of Hamid Karzai beyond Kabul. He was nicknamed the mayor of Kabul because he didn't really have a writ. You know, the original power brokers, the strongmen, were running Herat and Kandahar and places, Mazar-i-Sharif, etc. And the sort of, I think the hubris, the sort of flawed social experiment was that we could create this enormous nation-building program in support of Hamid Karzai and his government, and we could effectively rebuild the whole of Afghanistan and turn it into a model democracy in that part of the world. And that was a deeply flawed assumption. And I think that came about because of hubris of the 1990s and a number of successful interventions that had taken place, you know, from Macedonia and Sierra Leone and places like that. So there's sort of very, very flawed assumptions, but they were well-meaning assumptions, to be quite honest. And then, of course, yeah, where we all went wrong, where everybody went wrong, is in 2003, we were very distracted by the war in Iraq. We all took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan. And the US, the UK, and all of her allies just became more and more ingrained in Iraq. So by sort of 2004, 2005, we had two campaigns going on concurrently, and nobody wants that. That's just not a strategic, clever way to operate. And all of the resource, all of the political effort, all of the forces were being sent to Iraq. And Afghanistan was kind of largely ignored at a time when it was really critical. And that did allow the Taliban to kind of reconstitute. By the time that we had started to expand the numbers of troops, we had expanded and we were trying to extend the writ of governance into places like Mazar in the north, Herat in the west, Kandahar in the southwest. By that time, the Taliban were resurgent. I mean, you are absolutely right. What we got fundamentally wrong is we made this our war. You know, by piling in more and more Western troops, and you are absolutely right in what you say, they were always going to be unacceptable to a very, very traditional conservative group of people, particularly in southern Afghanistan, always going to be unacceptable. They were unacceptable during the Russian period, in a Russian occupation, and they were unacceptable during the 2000s. And to a certain extent, as we tried to expand democracy and governments and rule of law around the country, we created the insurgency, which eventually defeated us. By 2010, you know, everybody realized that the insurgency, the Taliban were massively resurgent and that this was an unwinnable war. And by that time, Hamid Karzai's government was so deeply corrupt. But actually many ordinary Afghans, you know, started to think maybe the Taliban are not such a bad example. Maybe they're not quite so awful. You know, given the choice between a deeply corrupt government-paid policeman or the Taliban, maybe we should have the Taliban back. Yeah, so you know, we stayed there for too long, one says with hindsight. I didn't think that when I was there in 2010. Yeah, I like many others, I could see some indicators of progress. I could see schools opening. I could see girls being educated. I could see the economy booming. What I couldn't see is all the deep fracture lines and all the rest of that. And that all became much more apparent in 2021. So it was a deeply flawed campaign, you know, and had we left in 2002, 2003, I don't know what would have happened. Worst cases, the Taliban would have come back in 2003, but hey, they're back anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting just hearing your answer is that I can see the sincerity in your own sort of mind and the clarity, and I'm sure in most of your colleagues also, about we are going there, we are going to try to, you know, do some sort of nation building. I just think there's lots of skepticism from anyone who is not part of the former colonies, but the former colonized rather, you know, who are previously colonized and not part of the colonizers, who think about this and say, it's not that the society is socially conservative and they're rejecting you. They're rejecting you because you're an outsider.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you are or what your intentions are or what our own problems are, unless we really, really need you and are asking for you, we are probably going to resist you across the society. And obviously, you weren't resisted across the society because the nature of deal breaking and society is like that. But invariably, the society will reject you, and it's very difficult, especially in Afghanistan. You are a military person, so you know this more than me. It's a very complicated place, lots of tricky terrain, massive country, very big country. I think people don't realize just how big it is. So it's very difficult to actually hold down a force there. And I suppose it speaks to a broader question, which we'll probably come to after we discuss Iraq and then go back to probably discussing Gaza. It's about sort of the prism of the colonized versus the colonizer. Iraq, I mean, there's a lot of agreement almost across the board now among experts, among everyone else, about what happened in Iraq. The cost of Iraq, though, is borne by Iraqis. Some would argue also Syrians. And the region as a whole, because some would argue that Israel's impunity extends to the fact that the U.S. behaved with restrained impunity in Iraq, compared to Israel, absolutely. But it unleashed an impunity by other actors that we saw in Syria and we saw in Iraq itself, which has now become, I mean, if you hear Douglas Murray, you hear people who defend Israel, they're like, people are getting killed in Iraq and they're getting killed in Syria and they're getting killed in Yemen. So what if 70,000 people, I mean, they don't exactly say this, but the thinking is, so what if 70 or 80,000 people have been killed in Gaza? Life in the Arab world is cheap. But it's that sort of, and it's true, like there were wars going on in that region for a long time, but there's this renewed impunity of action that is deep because of U.S. interference. And some would argue UK interference over the last 200 years that has caused a lot of instability in the region, caused a lot of wars, not the sole reason for the wars and instability. And it's kind of in the perception of those who can hold Western governments to power, it's made Arab life or brown life a bit cheap. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear you say that, but I don't disagree with any of your analysis there, to be quite honest. Yeah, I think the global South has lost all confidence, you know, in Europe and the United States as a result of what happened. And you're absolutely right, it goes back 20-something years to 2003 and the invasion of Iraq.
And some would argue 91, some would argue the funding the Iraq and Iran war from 1888.
One can keep going back, you know, the creation of Israel in 1948, yes. Others would kind of create a sort of big colonial experiment. I mean, we can't undo history, you know, it's kind of there. I think what we've got to do is learn the lessons from history and make sure that we don't continue and perpetuate the same sort of mistakes. And it was me, because I was going to sort of say to you, look, I think the era of intervention by Western nations is well and truly over. I think we learned our lessons from mistakes of Afghanistan and Iraq, but of course we then perpetuated the same mistake in Libya in 2010, 2011, and we've broken in Libya. So I'm not sure we have necessarily learned the lessons. But there's a danger here, though, that the pendulum springs completely the other way. And there are times when I think powerful Western nations have a responsibility to protect. I believe in this. It's not a very popular term now, this R2P, this concept, this idea that states have a responsibility to protect people from their own governments at certain places, and therefore there are times where there is a legal basis for an intervention, not even necessarily with a UN Security Council resolution. That was the basis really in which we went into Libya. And of course, because that R2P was so misused in Libya, that prevented, I think, the West from taking any meaningful action to prevent some of the atrocities that were committed in Syria during the civil war. And to a certain extent, you know, I glibly chucked something on social media a year ago and said, you know, where is the responsibility to protect the people of Gaza? when are the European nations are going to say, what about R2P doctrine? What about R2P international law? We have a responsibility to protect these people. And people just kind of laughed at it and just said, no, R2P is well and truly dead. And it is. And I I just kind of think this whole period, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and particularly the West's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza, has fatally undermined any kind of credibility that West had. And it has fatally undermined any credibility in the global institutions, which I once held dear. This idea of a rules-based international order, which we now means, you know, a US-based, rules-based order. It's as simple as that, as in what the US was. And I'm not surprised, you know, as a South African, and I can understand your view. South African stance is absolutely brilliant. But you know, South Africa's not an outlier, is it? You know, I suspect if you were to go out and lobby and poll the global South, they'll all tell you that the West is just morally bankrupt, and you know, its support for Israel is just totally discredited in the eyes. And therefore, it's discredited in the eyes of the UN General Assembly. You know, some of the decisions that have been made by the US and the UK, the way in which we voted in the UN General Assembly and the UN Security Council. I mean, the UN Security Council has got to be reformed. It's got to be reformed. It has to be. I don't know how it will be. But yeah, no, it's we can't change the past. But we're not in a kind of great position at the moment. And I mean, you know, what I find sort of staggering is this sort of gross hypocrisy where we seem to think that we are, you know, we have an inherent right to criticize Russia and Russians' action in Ukraine. And I think Russians' actions in Ukraine are abhorrent and they are illegal. But how can we have the hypocrisy of criticizing and condemning Russia when we're so prepared to support Netanyahu and Israel in Gaza? Is it any wonder we don't really have any credibility from the global South when we do that?
Where do you think, I mean, you mentioned that it was in the inevitably realpolitik that Israel would have said that it's going to defend itself and responded militarily to October 7th, but then they needed to be doing that alongside a diplomatic part. What would you have done?
What I think the Israeli response should have been?
Yeah.
God, I'm not an expert.
I mean, some would argue you are.
I could tell you what I wouldn't do is, yeah, I wouldn't sit there in my cabinet and say, well, the only solution is a military one, and we're going to destroy Hamas through military action alone, and we're going to bring about a better peace. I mean, that's complete and utter nonsense. And what I would say is, we need to sort of try and adopt a long-term political solution to this problem that in which a military instrument is one line of operation, but it's got to be diplomatic, it's got to be economic. I talk a little bit about Northern Ireland occasionally in the media, and I don't want to draw analogies between Northern Ireland and Gaza because they're trite, but the process that we went through, it took 30 years from 1969 to 1999 to bring about a political solution in Northern Ireland. And the military instrument was just one small part of that. That political agreement ultimately came about because we addressed the root causes of the conflicts. And they were about civil rights. They were about economical inequality. You know, they were about injustice of the Roman Catholics in Northern Ireland. It was about housing. It was about jobs. And when all of that was addressed, we got to a political solution. And that's the only thing that's going to bring about, in my view, a long-term solution in Israel. You cannot view Gaza in isolation. You cannot. Gaza is just one constituent part of what ultimately one day has got to be a Palestinian state. And if you just view Gaza in isolation, you're hitting a hammer with a nail, you know, and you're not looking at a wider problem that you're trying to kind of deal with. And that's kind of right. So kind of what should be done? Yeah, I would have said, look, you know, let's have kind of some kind of supercharged counter-terrorist response in Gaza against Hamas, which is a counter-terrorist campaign which is prosecuted within the law. It's prosecuted with distinction. It doesn't target civilians. And it is proportional to the response. It targets Hamas. And it's not going to deal with Hamas. It's not going to destroy Hamas. But it's going to attrit Hamas to a level that it is not capable of doing another 7th of October. And we'll keep doing that. We'll keep doing that. Maybe for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 years' time. Because in parallel, we're going to supercharge a political track that brings about a long-term political solution to the problem with Palestine and Israel statehood. That's what I would have done. Easy for me to kind of say, I don't know what it looks like, and really difficult with this particular coalition government in Israel. But until they do this, until they are prepared to look at the whole and not just look at Hamas, until they do that, then they're just going to carry on, you know, smashing away, banging away at the nail. But as I said earlier, I think that's that's part of their strategic approach.
Yeah.
It suits them to have a perpetual conflict, to a forever war.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, I mean, the key, that, I mean, because there's, I've also grappled with this question for a long time, and, you know, one state or two states, and then there's the examples of Northern Ireland and South Africa. And I think the first departure point with Israel, Palestine, and the UK, Northern Ireland, is that both parties wanted a solution that was political. And I think in the departure point in Israel, Palestine, is Israel doesn't want a political solution. And so before we get into the tactical situation of should they do this or should they do that, fundamentally, the paradigm that the Israelis are coming at this for the last 40 years, obviously there's variant differences, but on the whole for the last 40 years compared to the UK government, is that the Israeli solution is a non-solution. Whereas the UK wanted, maybe, of course, there were various prime ministers or various interest groups wanted, you know, a solution at a certain price, but wanted a solution. Mm. And I think with the apartheid government, it's almost the same. It's that by the time the 80s came and the 90s came, they realized that they would lose power. They realized they would be isolated. They realized that it was in their interests, or at least to come to some sort of situation, and they could maintain it. And I think that's the fundamental difference. I mean, I also think, and this is just out of interest, that I used to, you know, South Africa is a great example of a one-state solution. And when this conflict, the most recent part of it, the most iteration, when the genocide was unleashed, I was like, okay, it seems now that one-state solution, there's just too much animosity. But at the same time, now there's 800,000 settlers living in what would be a Palestinian state. So the two-state solution is also not feasible. And Israel's actions now, where they are pushing for ethnic cleansing, it's almost like both solutions aren't on the table, and they could be blowback because there's you know, the Arab world is becoming increasingly fragmented. There are 400 million Arabs, though, who to some extent, you know, feel affinity with the Palestinians and others don't. But at the whole, Israel is the implant, and they've made themselves more so the implant. They haven't really, on the whole, they had an opportunity for 8 years where they could integrate with the region, where they could become friendly neighbors. Obviously, there's been some blame on the Arab side as well, especially in the first 20 years where they, you know, saw Israel as this entity. But Israel hasn't helped the situation. And it's almost difficult to see any solution outside of massive violence. And at the moment, Palestinians being the victim of that violence, but the inevitability that there may come a point where the wheel turns.
Yeah, I mean, Israeli opposition to a solution is always a problem. I mean, but I think your South African analogy is a really kind of good one. You know, apartheid era South Africa didn't necessarily want a solution in the 1970s, but eventually it found itself completely globally isolated, didn't it? You know, huge economic sanctions and all the rest of that. It was forced into finding a solution, is that correct? Yeah. It was forced by international pressure. Israel could be compelled to be forced to find a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict issue, you know, to this question of Palestinian state. It could be. It's whether or not we're willing to do that. And the United States is clearly the key player in this. But there are other European nations that need to kind of play a part in this. And at the moment, we're not willing to. And until the international community, the West, is willing to compel Israel to do this, as you say, we're not going to get a solution. That's depressing, but it's a kind of reality.
No, it's true. I mean, do you see that wheel? Do you see that the international community, Israel has literally behaved beyond people's imagination in the last 2 years. I mean, I think if I asked you when you started becoming extremely disgusted back in January 2024, can you imagine that this is going to be what the next 20 months are like? You'd probably be like, no, it won't be that bad. And I think most people were of that orientation. And yet they still, by and large, have a lot of support, a lot of international support. It is decreasing, but not. I mean, they're still getting money, and they're still getting weapons, and they're still getting complicity in some of the military activities, as we mentioned, right? So, do you see that support sort of diminishing in any way? Because bear in mind that there is strategic interest, one some could argue, behind having Israel in where it is, because it kind of diminishes the ability of the Arab world to just kind of, you know, gain its own feet, slowly build representative government, slowly build a broad civil society. Because at the moment, what you have in the Arab world is you have Israel behaving as we know they are behaving, and then authoritarian governments that have the support of the US and other authoritarian governments that get their credibility by opposing the US. Mm. And I'm not saying that's by US design. one could argue it could be, but irrespective of whether it's by US design or not, it does mean that the US strategic interest possibly is fulfilled in that region because the region's depleted. And so they have time to, you know, use them as a depleted entity, or not use them, but rely on them for support against China or against Russia or against any other entity.
Super, super geostrategic. I mean, the optimist in me would like to think that, an ICJ ruling that Israel is or has committed genocide would be sufficient to change international support for Israel. The optimist in me suggests that it would do. The realist in me suggests that it'll be largely ignored, and all the United States will do and others will do is just seek to discredit the ICJ. So I'm not sure that international law, sadly, is going to play any kind of part in this. As I say, I think it's kind of really difficult. Trump will move on. Who knows what happens with the next US administration? I think the research in China, I think, is going to continue to preoccupy the United States. You already see, Russia, Ukraine is now, that's where the media attention is. That's where Trump's attention is. And this is why I think the real danger, I think, is that we end up with a frozen conflict. It's not really a frozen conflict.
It's a conflict, atrocity.
What one might call a low-intensity conflict, where international journalists are not able to enter Gaza, not going to be, because they will be able to see the atrocities that are going on. The Israeli Defense Forces will continue to occupy 53% of Gaza and will continue to surge into the other 47% at will, as and when they want. There'll be very limited reconstruction, and it will just end up as a low-level continued operation. So for the Palestinians inside Gaza, it's way worse than it was on the 7th of October, or on the 6th of October. It's weird. It's a proper occupation. That's my prediction as to where this is going to go. I'm not optimistic that this is going to end in anywhere better over the next couple of years. I think it's just going to be a kind of a low-level conflict. And it's heartbreaking. I can't believe I'm calling it a low-level conflict where 30, 40, 50 Palestinians are being killed every single day. That's not low-level if you're living inside Gaza. That's existential. But as soon as the Western media, and as soon as our eye's off this, it'll just kind of continue. I think that's kind of where it's going. And we've missed this opportunity to bring about some kind of fundamental change. To bring about some kind of long-term solution, by gosh, it's needed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I completely agree with you that Israel will continue. I don't believe that any ruling by the ICJ will significantly, unfortunately, realistically change the way that the big powers and Israel are behaving. Although it will become embarrassing and it will weigh a lot when it probably doesn't matter anymore in history. But I mean, it's, you mentioned sort of the stalemate and this low-level continued atrocity / conflict. 90% of all the buildings in Gaza have been completely demolished or destroyed or damaged in some way. We all see the images. Winter is coming. There's a shortage of tents. I think I read somewhere that there's 30,000 tents and people need 300,000 tents, which by math would say there's about 2 million people in Gaza. Maybe there's less. But there probably is, because that's the numbers according to what we have in terms of who's left and who's been killed. And even that tells you that 6 people to a tent. Yep. Without infrastructure, with limited food. I don't know what, no one understands the sanitary situation, the amount of disease that could be going around. It kind of seems like it's almost already very, very difficult, if not impossible, to just hold back a massive campaign which could, either by military force or other means, lead to a lot more death, and lead to, I think that if you just take the actual reality of the situation, it's very sad, but Gaza is possibly already gone.
Yeah. I mean, where do the people go? Miss the heartbreaking kind of thing. I think you're right. I think they're going to exist for a period of time in the most extraordinarily uncomfortable conditions, exactly as you describe. I mean, it's savage. It's absolutely savage. And we're complicit in it. We'll go on training Israeli soldiers in the UK. I read a report yesterday that we've had soldiers training in Israel over the last couple of years. We'll go on buying millions and millions of pounds worth of Israeli weapons every year, and we'll just turn a blind eye and pretend it isn't happening. And exactly as you say, 2 million people will live in abject poverty. I don't have an answer to it.
Yeah.
But where a brutal occupation occurs, then armed resistance will always continue, and it will grow. And Israel will, they'll cut off the flow of arms and material into Gaza. They probably kind of done that by occupying that southern border with Egypt. So the ability of the Palestinians in Gaza to resist this occupation will be reduced inevitably. But their long-term hatred and their determination to resist, and their will to resist, will never go away. It will never go away. Israel will find itself just incapable of building effective long-term relations with its neighbors while it treats the Palestinians in the way that it does. It's I don't want to be kind of gloomy about it, but it's difficult to be kind of optimistic about this at the moment. It really is. I think that the opportunities for optimism have sort of passed along the way over the last few years, and they seem to be kind of long gone now. Yeah, and those people who are sort of cheerleading this 20-point plan, I mean, utterly naive, simplistic view. It's just so deeply flawed.
I mean, I agree with you that it's deeply flawed, but what's your analysis on why it's flawed?
It's a solution that's been forced upon the Palestinians. It is a plan that has, as far as I can tell, no support from Hamas, actively resisting against this. The idea, they've said they will not tolerate an international stabilization force. Who's going to provide, this what do we call it, a board of peace chaired by Trump, Tony Blair, one of the names? I mean, how is this board of peace actually going to kind of operate? How and where is the international stabilization force going to operate? Where's it going to come from? There's not going to be an international stabilization force if Hamas resists it. It's not going to happen. Nobody's going to send their troops into that kind of area where they're going to be malleted by the Israelis and they're going to be malleted by Hamas. So you're not going to have an international. So the very basic underpinnings, the basic mechanics of how you maintain peace are not even there. And that's before we even start to talk about kind of reconstruction, which is, it's going to cost billions and billions and billions and billions. And I very much doubt that there is genuinely, the political determination by neighboring states and by the international community to fund that. So it's, and what, there've been 400 ceasefire violations?
And nothing happened. Probably more. It's
nothing
been about 335 happens. People killed since.
What would have been a better solution? I don't know. I don't know what would have been a better solution, but I know that this is not the right solution. Better solution. And again, it's not nested within a wider political solution to the wider question of Palestinian statehood. It just sits there in isolation, this Gaza 20-point plan. And desperately in preparation for this, I'm desperately trying to research, what is happening politically and diplomatically at the moment to re-energize talks about a two-state solution? Not very much. Nothing substantial.
Nothing substantial, yeah. Okay, let's just step back away from this and go back to a young Charlie Herbert, who was not yet in the army. Who were you, and what sort of motivated you to want to join the army?
Gosh, I grew up in Staffordshire, probably a relatively affluent middle class family. I had a good upbringing. I didn't particularly enjoy school. I think from the age of about 13, 14, I knew I wanted to join the army. I didn't come from a military background. My father was a businessman. And I was suspended from a couple of schools, and eventually school said, look, all he wants to do is join the army, just let him join the army. So I left school at the start of my A-levels. I started my A-levels, but I didn't complete my A-levels, and I joined the army shortly after my 17th birthday as a soldier, which was quite unusual for somebody who then goes on to relatively high rank. And I loved it. I loved it from the kind of day that I joined. I found my niche. I found my tribe, so to speak. And after 3 or 4 years, I was offered a chance to go and do officer training, go to Royal Military Academy Sandhurst and become an officer. And I didn't think I'd necessarily stay in the army. But I loved it. And, as we discussed earlier, I thought what I was doing throughout my career was good. You know, we used trite terms in the 1990s. I think there's this great saying that, you know, the British Armed Forces, a force for good. You know, people laugh at it now, but yeah, we all bought into that at the time. And I found my niche in the army, and I loved it. And as I said, you know, traveled around the world, generally doing what I thought was good things, to a point where I got to today.
When you started as a 17-year-old soldier, did you think you'd rise up the ranks? Did you have like a plan? Like, this is my career. Like, I'm just going to take it one day at a time.
No, I've never had a plan. wing it every day. No, I lack the imagination to have plans. No, I didn't. No, I didn't expect that I'd stay in the army for a career. When I went to Sandhurst, I thought, you know, I'd probably do a few years as a young officer. I commissioned from Sandhurst in 1990. While I was at Sandhurst, being over, the wall came down, the Soviet Union dissolved. It kind of looked like there wouldn't be a requirement for armed forces anymore. And I questioned whether there would be a career ahead of me, you know. And then, of course, 1991, the Gulf War. Yeah, I found I was in the Gulf War as a very young officer. And then I was in the Balkans in the 1990s, and then of course 9/11 happened. And so I never really had a kind of plan to stay in the army for any length of time, but it always interested me. And there was plenty of work, and I enjoyed it. It was a real privilege. It is a huge privilege to lead young soldiers. It really is. It might sound a bit odd to you, but it is a remarkable privilege to be given a role where one leads at age 20, 21, you know, 28, 29 young soldiers and more experienced soldiers. And in my view, do good. You know, I'm very proud of my role in the Gulf War and liberating Kuwait of an occupying force. Very, very proud. It's a short war, you know, but I thought, wow, you know, if this doesn't happen, you know, what happens? You know, sometimes, to me, it was kind of really good use of a military instrument. You had a UN Security Council resolution. You had global support for that campaign. And it was very exciting as a 21-year-old to be involved in that kind of war. It wasn't a particularly bloody war. It was over very shortly, or the ground war was over very, very quickly. I did see extraordinary loss of life on the Iraqi side. And one doesn't ever forget that. Conflict does come at a huge cost. War does come at a huge cost. And I saw that again in the Balkans in the early 1990s. That was a kind of real wake-up call for me. Yeah, that I had this vision. And I talk to people about conflict and war studies nowadays. And in every few years, you were learning more throughout my career. Bosnia was a real kind of learning experience. To see how war affects the civilian population. And we ignore that sometimes. We tend to think of war as a battle between two opposing forces. And you know, if it's fought in the deserts, as the Gulf War was, that's largely what it is. But when it's fought in Sarajevo or in Travnik or in Gaza or in Damascus or in Homs, it's war amongst the people. And the people that suffer are women and children in particular. And it's a horrendous experience to kind of be involved in that. And anybody who has been involved in that kind of conflict hates war and just wants to see it over. And sometimes I think politicians do commit the armed forces to war without really understanding the consequences of it. But yeah.
What thing that did you do in the army that made them say, okay, let's make this man a major general?
Wow. I suppose I didn't mess up too badly along the way. Maybe I was a little bit too vanilla. I didn't upset anybody enough. It's a good question. I don't know. It's an interesting era. I had a relatively conventional career. Weirdly, I really enjoyed being on operations. I enjoyed going overseas on challenging operations. So I spent a lot of my time volunteering to go to Iraq, to go to Afghanistan, to go to Sierra Leone, I wanted to do that. Whereas lots of other people are more happy working in the Ministry of Defence or Army Headquarters or working in a procurement job or finance role. And I suppose, you know, I was very lucky that I had those opportunities. And over a period of time, I was promoted. You know, don't get me wrong, it wasn't because I was particularly good at my job. I guess I was just incredibly fortunate. I rose up through a variety of command positions. I commanded a company of 100 soldiers on two tours in Iraq in middle 2000s. I commanded my battalion in Iraq in 2008. I commanded a battalion in Afghanistan in 2010. And those were, I suppose, both career opportunities in to a certain extent, but allowed one to advance. But I was surprised as anybody, but I ended up as a major general.
And just going back, just a few more questions. Just going back to when you were 13, 14, what was the appeal? Was it the institution of the army? Was there a political appeal? You wanted to get, you know, wanted to make sure the Russians don't take over the world? Like, what was the...
I think probably the greatest influence was the Falklands War in 1982, when I was probably about 13. And it was a relatively straightforward conflict between two nations, but wasn't really fought amongst the people. It was fought a very long way away. It was a joint campaign with a task force. It had a UN Security Council resolution. It was all right. And it was a sort of conflict that was quite appealing to a young man. Here's the British Army doing great things, you know, in direct support, restoring sovereignty to the United Kingdom, you know. It was all, you know. And I was inspired by people like Lieutenant Colonel H. Jones, who lost his life in the Falklands while commanding Two Power. In what I saw was an extraordinary act of leadership and self-sacrifice. And so I was inspired by things like that. Maybe it's a bit gung-ho as one looks back at it, but I think the Falklands had a very significant impact on me at that time, you know, and it playing out on the news every night, reading the newspapers, and I was aware of what was going on. My cousin was a few years older than me. He went into the army. He went in as an army officer probably when I was about 14. I think that was another sort of factor. But I think I was just, to a certain extent, kind of looking for a home that suited me. I liked the idea. At that time in the 1980s, most of the army was overseas in Germany, to be quite honest. We had other bases in Gibraltar and Hong Kong and Central America, etc. But the bulk of the army was in Germany, and it was facing off against a very clear enemy, which was the Soviet Union. So it was kind of quite, there was a clarity and a unity of purpose about it that very much appealed to me. And I enjoyed being in an institution as I talked about earlier, an institution that had very firm values and standards and beliefs and integrity. So the term integrity ran through officer training. I really believed in that, and it appealed to me. And I don't get me wrong, I still miss the army. I left in 2019 after 34 years. I miss the unity of purpose that we had. I miss this can-do sense that one found in the military. I miss this sense of teamwork and camaraderie, of people pulling in the right direction. I don't find that very often outside of the military, to being honest. So that's why I do. I still hold the institution dear. You know, it's not without its flaws. Yeah, the armed forces, like any large institution, is imperfect. You know, and the fact that the army is, what, 350 years older, you know, certain things, traditions and history does hold it back to a certain extent.
And if you could imagine yourself being 13 or 14 in 2005, 2025, or 15 or 16, how do you think you'd still, like, if you were a kid right now, a 14-year-old kid, do you think you'd want to join the army? And if not, why not?
Great question. If I said no, but I probably wouldn't join that, that's only because over my lifetime there are other things that I've seen that kind of really appeal to me. I mentioned that time when I was in Sierra Leone during Ebola, and I saw the incredible work of infectious disease doctors, specialists who devoted their entire life to dealing with things like viral hemorrhagic fevers in Africa. And I've got an extraordinary respect for professional healthcare workers. And I think if I went back to being 13, the conversation that I have with myself would be, work hard at school, dedicate yourself, and perhaps go into something like that rather than the military. There's no particular reason why I wouldn't. But the military has changed. You know, when I joined in 1985, there were probably about 170,000 people in the army. There's now probably about 70,000. It's a much smaller, it's nearly all UK based. It's less clear now. There's less of an existential threat to the United Kingdom. You know, 10 years ago, we were talking about that threat being terrorism. Now we're talking about that threat being a resurgent Russia. So it's kind of less clear. So I don't know if the army would have the same appeal to me. I certainly wouldn't have any objections to it from a sort of ethical or a philosophical basis. I still believe that those young men and women, increasingly women, that's a big change in my lifetime, but those young men and women who go into the army go in for the right reasons, and have a real sense of duty and loyalty and service to their country. And I wish we could just kind of, we struggle a bit, the military, I say we as if I'm still in the military. It's interesting. It's hard to get away from that. I wish the military could kind of more appeal to society in 2025. I think it is less appealing to young people of today. And I think the army, it does great work, in particular, trying to attract from the BAME community. It really does. The army wants to be, armed forces, they want to be ethnically diverse. They want to represent society, but they are really struggling to attract from that cohort. But it's not for want of trying. And I really wish that they could crack this. Because we, you know, the armed forces will only be correct and right and only be representative when they genuinely represent society in that regards.
Okay, just final reflection, which is a response to what you said, and then get your reflection. But I mean, you've seen, because you are, you know, I guess from your military experience, but also before that, you are definitely into the news. You follow the news closely. You, and as a result of following the news, you have developed views which are extremely critical of Israel. Do you think, as a 14-year-old, you would have been on Instagram and TikTok and seeing Middle East Eye and Al Jazeera as well, and that would have been like, No, I'll never join the army because these guys are complicit in the genocide?
That's a great question. Yeah, I'd have been disappointed. Yeah, if I was on Instagram reading, if I was reading Charlie Herbert's Twitter feed, you know, X feed, I don't want to be part of any organization that supports that. Yeah, it's interesting. Young people today, I thought young people today were all super politically aware, they're not, are they? I mean, I've got a 16 and 19-year-old. My 19-year-old is becoming increasingly politically aware. And she, over the last 2 years, has really started to take an interest in the world around her, which is really encouraging. And she's at Bristol University studying sociology. And she's becoming kind of really politically aware. And I think increasingly left-wing in her views, which I'm loving. Yeah, my boy is 16 and he just still lives for Chelsea Football Club. And I'm dismayed at his lack of political interest in the world around him. Yeah, we've got to get young people interested in politics. But yeah, somebody described my journey as my political awakening. I can't remember if it was Owen Jones or Matt Kennard or somebody. and it's really interesting because I suspect, you know, at 21, I was probably centre-right, you know, my political leanings. You know, now I'm increasingly left-wing in my views. And actually, that's been a sort of gradual awakening. And not necessarily shared by many. A lot of people say to me, a lot of ex-veterans say to me, how come you're so left-wing, Charlie? It doesn't make sense. You're a retired general. I go, no, don't worry. I want a two of us for things like that. I want a two of us for vote for the Green Party, et cetera. Interesting journey.
Sorry, I know. I said that this will be the last question, but now this is the last question. Have you, and you don't have to give me names or anything, but have you actually fallen out with some of your ex, you know, veteran friends? Due to views on Gaza?
I wouldn't say friends. There are those who I battle with on social media, big prolific names. You know, Richard Kemp, I despise Richard Kemp's political views on social media. He's very involved in an IDF supporting charity. He seems to have become a spokesman for Daily Telegraph. I abhor the fact that he and I served in the same military, to be quite honest. I find that really distasteful. There's another chap who I'm not going to name because we had a very public spat on social media, former parachute regiment officer. I don't understand his views. We fall out. We're just diametrically opposed. But what I don't get, this isn't about politics. This isn't about whatever. It's about the law. It's really, and it keeps coming back to this. What the IDF do, have done, again and again and again and again, is unlawful. It's as simple as that. It's binary. It's really simple. You commit war crimes when you shoot detainees after they've surrendered. That is unlawful. That shouldn't be open to debate and judgment, subjectivity. It's unlawful. And I think the IDF's actions in Gaza over the last 2 years have been deeply unlawful. And how anybody can support that staggers me. Staggers me.
Major General Charlie Herbert, thank you for your time.
God bless you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.